May I please the court? I'd like to go straight to what I perceive to be Mr. Merriman's central argument. That is, as I understand it, that despite the disciplinary system's 6 efforts through admonitions to improve and save his practice, that after repeated practice failures, such as losing clients' files and failing to talk to his clients, failing to work on their cases for one case as much as a year, and more violations that led to those 6 admonitions, and now 3 more clients who were completely abandoned by him, one of whose, 2 of them were bankruptcy clients, one of them was of those 2, they were paid, he was paid in advance, and he kept, essentially used that money as his own for 2 years, up to 4 years for part of that money, doing no work for those clients. The 3rd client was a workers' comp client that he didn't, he was too drunk to meet with him, met with him once, but the deposition was too drunk, and then he was too drunk to have a pre-trial meeting, and then was too drunk to even appear at the hearing. That despite those things, that, as I understand his central argument, the court should allow him to continue to practice. Because
we often allow, redemption. We allow redemption if the person's cured their problem, their alcohol or drug problem. Has he shown any evidence? It seems like after he was on probation or whatever, he then had a DWI. And is there any evidence you have seen anything presented to you that he is on the right path, or he's not an alcoholic now, which has been the problem of his one of the problems of his disciplinary action?
Sure. I think he would agree that he'll always be an alcoholic, but whether or not he's in recovery, and his recovery is sustained and meaningful, as the ABA sanction standards suggest we should use in determining how much redemption or mercy to apply in these cases. The evidence is not good. The evidence is that the treatment failed within a year or so after his 1-year-long inpatient, mostly inpatient program. He was drinking again, several relapses according to his AA sponsor, and then, as you mentioned, a new DWI after that.
Well, how long has he been without any incidents or, to our knowledge, drinking? It's been a year?
Well, the record ends at the time of the hearing, which would have been February of 2007, and at that time, his testimony was that he hadn't had anything to drink since the DWI, which would have been, I think, either early 2006 or 2005. So the only record is to that date, and that's only his testimony.
As far as mitigating evidence, Mr. Merriman has made restitution, reimbursement of fees to all of his clients. Is that correct?
He has. One of them has. He has, but not very timely, in my view. In other words, 4 years and a year, 2 or 3 years. Some of it was 4 years. Some of it was done 18 months. Some of it was 2 years, and some of it wasn't done for 4 years until just before the hearing.
And that's because, the action been filed against him, and that's when he didn't do anything until there's disciplinary action filed.
He certainly didn't do it just because the clients, because he knew there was a complaint. It was quite a while after the complaints were filed that he started making the payments to reimburse.
So one of my concerns
before the hearing was complete, before the hearing was started. Actually.
I assume by this action, one of my concerns is really protection of the public. Is OCDC's position that the public's in danger as long as this lawyer is still practicing?
Yes, that is precisely our position, that there is great risk because we really, when we do these cases, we determine fitness of lawyers to practice. Courts have said that repeatedly. And to do that, we have to look backwards. We have to look at their conduct that brought us to the court this day, and in this case, it's not a very good record, and frankly, it's not a good treatment success record, and it's not really a very good record of the disciplinary system's effect to improve his practice over the 6 years that the admonitions were issued.
Well, you say we should suspend with leave to apply for reinstatement in 1 year. What would he need to show then that he's not able to show now? What would make the difference?
Okay.
And what kind of case would what he's asking for?
I think there are a couple of responses. One is, more time. I mean, I think that is important, and that's what I think the alcohol treatment experts would tell us, is that you should have more time, and there should be some monitoring during that period. Another point is the protection of the public may require that he be removed, even if we could guarantee that he's not going to have another drink, or we can't, because the record is so bad that at some point the court has to say, if we're going to assure that lawyers know that they can't misbehave repeatedly and continue to not taking care of their client's business, then they have to be removed as a consequence.
But you're not asking for disbarment. And I'm just trying for the court to draw a distinction between this case, and I know there's others where there's been successful interventions and lawyers will come back to practice, but under careful probation and monitoring to ensure that they're they're representing their clients well and not harming the public. How do we distinguish where it's appropriate to do that versus here you believe it's not versus the cases where disbarment may be required?
Right. For one thing, I think probation will be appropriate at the time of his reinstatement. But I think that and those are tough calls. And if you look back at the many cases that the court had, clearly in misappropriation cases.
No, I'm talking about where there's been substance abuse or right. Or alcohol abuse situations, how do we draw those distinctions?
Well, one of the ways the court has done it in the past is in misappropriation cases, which we're not alleging is directly misappropriation, although we use the client's money, is that those cases, there's a lot less mercy or a lot less opportunity for mitigating factors to even be considered. So we're not at that, we're
right.
not there, and that's one place. The other case is, I think that's probably the primary thing, is that it's not just a stealing case, so there is an opportunity for mitigation. And so that's why we're not at this bar.
Following up with this question, I think you could be, there's a lot of functioning alcoholics out there to do a job and don't hurt their clients. This is a situation where he did hurt his clients, and so there's a higher standard to get him back into the practice. How would he have to prove he's clean and sober, or would you require affidavits? How would they prove that in a year's time in order to get back into the practice?
Well, differently than the burden should be on him. I mean,
oh, sure, but how would he do that? That's the burden.
And I think he should start tomorrow, when the court's order is issued, and working with counselors to develop a record that I've been in treatment, I've gone to AA once a week, once a day, whatever the counselors recommend, and that I haven't had a drink, and my sponsor is willing to testify.
Is there no such evidence now since the hearing a year ago?
There's no such evidence.
There's
nothing in the record since
the hearing. The admonition started in 1993 and then jumped to 96. And was there evidence of the cause of the violation of the rules, such as alcohol abuse, all through that history, or did it only impact some of the violations?
The record does not answer that. We can all have our guesses, but the record, apparently he didn't tell the regional disciplinary committees, I wouldn't have been there except I've been drinking. Then there was one of the admonitions that did reflect the health condition, but it wasn't fleshed out within the admonition itself.
The brief says that he candidly expressed to the panel here, recommendation. He candidly expressed his ongoing struggle with alcoholism. Were there any details as to the time frame for that struggle with alcoholism?
Yes. His AA sponsor said that he started going to AA with him, I think, in 96, 97. I think the respondent mentioned 1998, so probably in that time period. Nobody had their calendars with them. Probably in that time frame is when he started recognizing that condition.
You list as one of the conditions that he must maintain malpractice insurance. Was he not maintaining that before?
I think they did. I'm fairly certain that the record is that he was asked that, and his answer was no, that he didn't have any at the time of the hearing.
Was he practicing at that time?
He hasn't been in good health, and
right.
his attorney can explain that better. And so, as I recall, the testimony was he hasn't been able to have a full-time
right.
practice for quite some time.
And that, of course, would be a reasonable condition, since he's shown that the clients are at risk. having legal malpractice would then protect the client's interest.
Right. We agree with the disciplinary hearing panel that that would be a good idea at the time of a reinstatement. One of the other points that I think you wanted to make was that there are delays in this case. It is old. I think that most of them are attributable to his health condition and the disciplinary hearing committee, in Kansas City, as well as the disciplinary hearing panel, giving him more time at his request. 2006 was mostly filled up with his three requests, one for appointed counsel and then three different requests for extension. 2004 was filled with even responding to the Kansas City committee because he asked for more time even before he responded.
So the delay is his at his request, but February 07 is not necessarily that far. We've seen cases that are 10 years old, but February 07.
You're right, yes.
You guys have cleaned up the backlog very well, by the way.
And we're continuing to work on it.
I know. But this is February 07, and that's...
Well, it's February 07 when it came here.
Right.
So, yeah, right. I think this case is moving. Once it's here, it's moved along. February 07 when it... Right.
I'm confident it didn't get here then. Perhaps that's when they issued their decision below.
I think that's right. It may have been June even.
Was it June of 07?
I believe that's right. I have the time.
Or that's when the hearing was in February 07, is that?
Right. Yeah. That's right. The hearing was in February 07, and I think it came, their decision was reported in June 07. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. Your honors, there's no secrets here today. Bill Merriman is an alcoholic. He's always going to be an alcoholic. It's a disease that is never cured. It's a disease that is fought on a day-to-day basis. The question was asked, what has Bill done to show this court that he's dealt with this disease? He checked himself into a year-long stay at the Welcome House. Welcome House is a very Spartan, strict living arrangement in Kansas City. The requirements are that there's intense counseling. The requirements are that there's no alcohol. He successfully completed that year between January of 2003 and January of 2004. Since that time, Bill has participated in Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes several times a week. When his health permits, he goes every day.
He's had lapses since that time, is that right?
He had one lapse in February of 2006, Your Honor. It's not an excuse, but it was coincides with his diagnosis of colon cancer. He had been previously treated with bladder cancer. Again, no excuse. It did happen. There was a relapse. There is no evidence, and there have been no relapses since February of 2006. We are now 2 years down the road. So, in effect, he has demonstrated, although the record closes, I understand, below with the testimony, but there have been no further problems with Mr. Merriman. He's got his life.
Do you have expert testimony? Did you submit expert testimony to the effect that he's not a danger to the clients, to the public?
The testimony
that he is cured of the not cured, but he's a recovering alcoholic and he is no danger to the clients?
There was no expert medical testimony. The testimony that I think was the most persuasive was from his sponsor, Dennis Mays. And he talked about the mindset of alcoholics and what he's observed in Mr. Merriman over a period of 10 years. And that is that the mindset has to change in order to beat this disease, and that his testimony was that Bill has achieved that mindset. He wants to beat this disease, and he's beating it every day. But it's going to be a continual fight. There's no question.
He's not under any suspension now, but is he, or is he? Your client, is there any interim suspension in this case?
I don't believe so.
So he could practice right now, but it has not been.
I haven't looked at that issue. I think that's correct. Think okay.
But he's been noncompliant with the ethics requirements as far as CLEs.
There was no question that I think it was between 2002 and 2004. I may be off on the dates, but there was a period of years in which he had attended the CLEs, but he hadn't submitted the paperwork. He was not compliant because he didn't do so. That's a violation of the rule, no question about it. I think what's significant there is that in March of 2005, before this information was filed, he had gotten all of his reports to the CLE director and had received a letter from Chris Janku in March of 2005 acknowledging that he was now caught up on all of his CLEs. There haven't been any further violations of the CLE.
When was the last time he was in active practice?
I think that it's fair to say probably in fall of 2002. The record's not entirely clear, but I think it's been on a limited basis since the Welcome House, because that really what we're talking about, there's a narrow period of time from late 2002 to early 2003 when he neglected his clients. And there were three clients that were involved here, Coker, Morton, and Mary. And I believe that since that time, he's been in the hospital quite a bit. There's quite a bit of testimony about that. And I think the record would show that he's had very little practice, although I think he still has some.
So there are no complaints since 2003?
Not that I'm aware of.
How do we... it's difficult having a year here without any evidence as to what his doctors currently think about his situation and whether he's attending AA and so forth. How do we deal with that in making this decision?
Well, and quite frankly, I think that the solution that a respondent recommended to the panel is the way that you deal with it, because it puts the teeth in on the front end. What I suggest is appropriate for Mr. Merriman is that he be put on suspension in conjunction with probation, and that probation ought to have teeth, and that teeth be that he report.
Well, if he's suspended, there's no
problem. You're saying state is suspended.
In conjunction. That there would be some teeth in that, and that he has to report weekly, daily, monthly, whatever the chief disciplinary counsel thinks is appropriate, report his AA meetings, have his sponsor report, have him come for random urinalysis tests. There are a lot of ways that you can put the teeth in up front, and that way, the keys are in the respondent's hands. He's got the obligation to do these things. It's a lot easier to prove ongoing compliance under that scenario than it is to come back to the bar and say, okay, now I've got a letter from a doctor that says I've been clean for a year. What does that mean? Well, the application's been processed, and you still have to have ongoing conditions. So I would submit that in conjunction with probation, state at this point with significant teeth, with the requirement of medical malpractice, malpractice insurance, to build those in. And then the chief disciplinary counsel has the supervision, has the oversight, and if he slips up, then it's real simple.
Would your client have any objection were this court to delay deciding what to do in this case until it was able to get updated information about his situation and what's been going on in the next? I would certainly hate to be in a situation where if we were to accept your invitation to stay the suspension and let him practice under probation and we find out he's had three DWIs in the last year that didn't come to our attention and he's not been going to AA, but that would seem to be a possibility under the scenario you suggest.
And I think, quite frankly, to answer your question, we'd be happy to submit whatever additional evidence the court would want to see to satisfy itself that since the record closed below that he hasn't had any further problems. I guess one of the things I also mentioned is that under the terms of the DWI, which he voluntarily reported it to the chief disciplinary counsel, this was not something that they found on their own, but under the terms of that suspended imposition of sentence, He can't drink. He can't have any further violations. And if he did, his probation would be revoked. And so there's kind of a secondary parallel suspension that's been going on for the last year.
The DWI was in 06.
February of 06. The conviction was, the plea was approved in November of 06.
And so how much longer is it probate? Is he still on probation now?
My understanding runs until November of 2008.
That's a misdemeanor or a felony?
I believe it's a misdemeanor. I think it bears some discussion of the mitigating factors and what some of the evidence is in this case. It's true that there was a delay in the refund to the various clients of the fees. But what I would submit is that in light of his treatment for cancer, and in light of the fact that he was in-house treatment for a year, and in light of the fact that he suffered a personal bankruptcy because of his inability to pay for the substantial medical bills, that making the restitution within the time period that he did was timely. And for example, with the Mort case, $1,000 was repaid in installments in March of 04 and December of 04. There was one installment that was late. This was in September of 2006. By miscalculation of the amount of the retainer, there was an additional $50 that hadn't been repaid. And so Mr. Merriman repaid that along with $250 interest in December of 06. And so that the latest one in 06 was paid with substantial interest, and again, it was evidence in the records that it was a miscalculation on his part. It was just an additional $50.
You indicated his misconduct was from late 02 to January of 03, but I thought I remembered from the briefs, that he went to Welcome House, that his clients were not told where he was, and that there was ongoing files or information he had that they didn't have access to. Am I misremembering the brief, or did his misconduct extend for much longer than late 02 to January 03?
There's two different aspects of that. I think with respect to the two bankruptcy clients, Merritt and Moore, both of them, I believe, evidence was that they retained other counsel to represent them in March or April of 2003. So as far as his representation of them, that effectively ended by March or April 2003. With respect to Mr. Coker, he was terminated in January of 2003 following the incident of the hearing. I think what, Your Honor, you may be remembering is that there was an allegation that Mr. Merriman had not turned over files to Mr. Coker's subsequent counsel, and I believe the stipulation was that there was a delay in getting those files to him, but that ultimately there had been no prejudice to Mr. Coker as a result of the delay in getting the files.
But the rule says you're supposed to, I think it's 1D or something. When did that occur? When did he hand over the files?
I think the record was that the files were turned over in August of 2003. I don't know. Let me back up. I think the record is not entirely clear. I think that Mr. Merriman's testimony was that he turned over substantially all the files as soon as he received a request from Mr. Falcone to do so. There was a suggestion that there was some portion of the file that hadn't been turned over, but whatever was in question was complete by August of 2003.
Now, what about the trust account? Did he put money into the trust or commingle funds without a trust account? Did he have a client trust account?
Well, I guess I'd answer it this way. My understanding of the allegations and the complaint did not include any complaint as far as trust account. So I don't think that was really part of the issues before the panel. I think what he testified is that he didn't recall what account he had put it into. There was some discussion about a portion of it was for costs, I think $250, and the other portion was for fees. And I don't know that the record was ever really clear what type of account that was deposited in. I'd like to talk just a little bit about some of the cases that this court has to look to for guidance here. And I know we've spent a lot of time talking about probation here, and I feel that that's probably where the court is at least focusing its attention. But I would at least point out that if you look at the, for example, the CLE violation standing by itself, in the Shellhorse case, this court has said that reprimand was appropriate. In that case, Mr. Shellhorse had failed to comply for 4 years, but the court found that his failure to comply with the requirements didn't harm the public. Again, if you just look at it in a vacuum, that's the appropriate reprimand for the CLE requirements. Likewise, with respect to the client funds, the cases that we've cited in our brief indicate that reprimand is appropriate when you've had a negligent action with respect to the client funds. In this case,
they're not taken in isolation. If there's a combination of different violations, and in fact, the ABA recommends a sort of graduated approach. If you have one violation and you violate something else later, it's a graduated approach. So it's not. So there's a multiple number of violations that also could accumulate to a serious discipline.
I don't disagree, Your Honor. I'm simply pointing out that if you look at them, compartmentalize the violations here, that in and of themselves they don't rise to the level of suspension. What I think what we're looking at is because of the totality of the circumstances, is suspension then appropriate? Finally, I think that what you would look at in determining the discipline would be whether or not probation is appropriate.
Another perspective is not in the courtroom right now, and to some extent we have to look at that is the perspective of the client and the public. Here's someone who's trying to clear bankruptcy, hires a lawyer, goes to the hearing, and his lawyer isn't there, and conceivably can't get a hold of him, and maybe he's being garnished, maybe he's having his house threatened, his home may be taken away, and he's got nothing. He hired a lawyer to deal with those issues.
Well, I think that it was the informant's burden to show the court that there was vulnerability and injury to those bankruptcy clients. I think other than the fees, which I've already talked about, neither Merritt nor Moore testified, and the court didn't permit any testimony as to whether or not they were vulnerable. I think that there was no evidence that they didn't have houses, they didn't have jobs, they weren't otherwise able to pay some of their bills, but they simply had some financial decisions that made them work out badly. I think in toto, though, I think the probation...
Having represented many people who are judgment-proof, and they don't go for bankruptcies unless they have some assets they want to protect. It makes no sense otherwise.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. I would say that, again, the record was void of any evidence of that kind of harm to either Mr. Merritt.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
I think the issue is the protection of the public. While we want to be merciful all the time to the people that we deal with, it is the public's interest that have to be that are primary in this. And I think it's too great a risk to take.
How do we know? I mean, a lot of times cases come up here by stipulation, and there's been a diversion, and there's been reports. Why was there nothing done here in the interim to see, and maybe there's no mechanism for it, I'm just curious, but often there's a diversionary program prior to our decision on any kind of discipline that's necessary where the person, if they're going to a doctor, submits periodic reports or, I know there's been no practice here, but it's kind of hard to make a decision on whether or not he's sufficiently recovered when we don't know what's happened in the last year, and I don't know what the solution is.
We don't have the last year's evidence. I don't know the solution either. I mean, but frankly, these cases are always about looking backwards, and we're always going to be stuck with that. And the record here, I think, is years of alcoholism, a year, then a year-long treatment program, and then relapses after that.
But since so three of them
today, the risk is too great given what happens to his clients.
Is it just a single relapse, or were there multiple relapses?
Actually, there was the DWI, and his sponsor said that there were several other relapses during that year, during the year previous.
But the last complaint was in 03, so that's an issue. But you know, let's say we suspended him until he proves that he's that he is clean and sober. So what would you require? What would you require if at all, could anything be sufficient to prove to you that he is capable of going back to practice?
We deal with that all the time in reinstatement applications. And the answer is we try to get as much evidence as we can as to their effort, their commitment, their effort not just to say, I'm going to do better at it, but to get treatment and to stay.
Do you get medical testimony saying that he has been, he is recovering? What kind of testimony?
That's exactly what we try to get all the time in those reinstatement cases.
And that would be your decision to reinstate. I mean, well, we wouldn't hear it. We'd go back to you in a year.
We take positions, and the court decides who should be reinstated and who shouldn't be. I just asked the court to follow the disciplinary hearing panel's recommendation, to follow the court's past guidelines. I think there's three or four cases cited in our brief suggesting that in these types of cases, probation, that the suspension, hard suspension, is appropriate. And then following the ABA sanction guidelines, all three of those, I think, clearly indicate or do indicate that suspension is appropriate and that probation is appropriate at the time of reinstatement. Thank you.
Thank you.